You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 14th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Mike Konzel, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, on their recently, or I should say just released report, an unfinished mission, making Wall Street work for us. Timed nicely with the hearings of Janet Yellen, her nomination hearings to be Fed chair, taking place on the Hill. As we speak, also as we speak, President Obama set to speak and announce support for legislation to perhaps allow insurance companies to continue to offer their crappy product to you if you're already a consumer of that crappy product. Is it for one more year? I don't know.
I'm seeing the leak says it would be you allowed to renew it for one more year. But we'll see what he says, obviously.
Yes, we're going to see. And the key differences between the Upton proposal in the House and the Landrieu proposal in the Senate, I will discuss. There's a lot of controversy. Well, I should say disagreement as to, is this political mitigator? Is it a policy disaster? We will talk about that as the show progresses. Also on the program, the ethanol mandate. It's time to unwind it, folks. The proof is in. Ethanol, no good. I mean, I think we've known that. But now we're going to find out if the EPA has done anything about it. Michael was going to get me that information about the EPA, but he was too busy tweeting different stuff, apparently, to remember to do that. We will also, I mentioned last week that the judge who had ruled Shira Shineland, the U.S. District Judge who had ruled that the New York Police Department had engaged in unconstitutional racial profiling in its stop and frisk program, was essentially deemed last week to have violated ethics rules. Apparently, the same court that had deemed that and thrown her off the case issued an opinion on Wednesday that they didn't really mean that she had violated the ethics rules. They said that they stood by the removal of Shineland based on the appearance of impartiality, but they did not mean to imply that she was actually impartial and that she had engaged in misconduct either under the code of conduct or under the judicial conduct. So there was no ethics violation, just an appearance of potential ethics violation. So she will not be on that case. However, this will undercut the Bloomberg administration's attempt to appeal her first ruling, because it's clear that she wasn't, in fact, impartial. She will not be on the case to determine how to execute policies that will bring stop and frisk within a constitutional framework. But all this may be moot anyways, as Bill de Blasio will rejigger the policy. So that's the end of that little drama, though it really does beg the question, what was going on with this appellate court? All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Konzel from the Roosevelt Institute. Also, don't forget podcastawards.com. You got two more days, today and tomorrow, to vote. Podcastawards.com. Vote for us for best politics and news, and also for People's Choice. Then make sure that you just confirm your email address. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Mike Konzel, fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, the co-author of the new report, An Unfinished Mission, Making Wall Street Work for Us. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back on.
I genuinely appreciate it. I know you want to watch the Yellen hearings and the Obama press conference, and, of course, to find out what Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, has been doing in his off hours. So I triply appreciate your making the time for us.
There's so much fun stuff going on.
It is. It's quite a day. Now, your report was came out, I guess it was Tuesday, and coincided with an event that you had where Elizabeth Warren was spoke on her perception of where Dodd-Frank has fallen short. She continued talking about that today with Yellen. Just give us a sense of what the report is supposed to deal with, and how Elizabeth Warren highlighted those aspects.
Sure. So the report's called An Unfinished Mission. It's by the Roosevelt Institute and the Americans for Financial Reform. And it's 12 chapters available online at our site, RooseveltInstitute.org. We called it an unfinished mission for two reasons. One is that Dodd-Frank is itself not finished yet, and there's still a lot of rules being written, a lot of really big decisions like the Volcker Rule and so on and so forth that are going to make a real big difference in how the financial sector looks in the short term. We try to provide a guideline or kind of like guideposts and discussion about what still needs to be done, what has gone well, what has done poorly. And so there's that kind of issue with essentially dealing with too big to fail. In Elizabeth Warren's speech, she talked about how she doesn't believe too big to fail has been finished yet or has been ended yet. And also that regulators, I think, secretly kind of understand that, and they're looking for ways to try to deal with that. The second question, and this is the unfinished mission, the second half of the report, is kind of what kind of financial, given that the kind of immediate crisis problem is kind of in that policy sector, what does it mean to have a financial sector that really works for the real economy? What does it mean to have financial sector that might abuse commodities, for instance, or be way too large for the overall economy without producing any kind of real value? What does it mean to have a shadow banking system that kind of has an intermediate, that can kind of cause all kinds of abuse and panics and perpetual crashes? How do we want to structure the financial sector 10 years from now? And that's also unfinished. And that's not even a discussion we're really having right now. And so we wanted to put it forth and kind of say, what does this mean? And how can we start to structure a discussion about it?
And before we get into the sort of the details of those two halves of it, the failures of Dodd-Frank at this point, and of course, you know, 60% of it, I think, has not actually been implemented yet. And in some respects, there are failures that are both process oriented, that are a function of the process, and perhaps a function of the ambition. Those failures, in some ways, leads to the second discussion, right? I mean, insofar as maybe the entire approach of Dodd-Frank was not the right approach.
Right. So there's, I mean, I think the approach of Dodd-Frank tried to answer a few really specific questions that have to do with, you know, what kind of response do we want for the immediate crisis of Lehman Brothers and AIG? I think it purposely did not really focus on the big questions of what kind of financial sector do we want to have for our real economy. So, you know, you get to a lot of the rule writing. Now, a lot of the rule writing is just that they gave themselves really difficult deadlines. Like the CFTC was supposed to have a lot of derivatives rules done within a year, which was kind of insane. Some of it's been harassment, just defunding and really conservative courts and so on and so forth. But a lot of it has been them kicking the can on these really fundamental questions of things like, should we prevent big financial firms from running hedge funds with public support, which is the Volcker rule question. That's a thing you can do in a really hard and clear way that would be beneficial for the real economy but hurt financial firms. Or it's you can do it in a kind of mushy way that would blur a lot of lines and have a lot of exceptions. And regulators are really kicking the can on that, and they're finally getting to a point where they can't kick it anymore.
And isn't that, I mean, that's, I guess that was the point where I was getting at, is that there are two different sort of philosophies on how you approach that. The one is you create a framework where regulators can come in with a scalpel and sort of mitigate the implications of the way that everything has become financialized and innovative, in quotations. Or you come in with an axe and you simply say, we're going to cleave off the growth of this sector in such a way that regardless of what happens, it cannot create a systemic risk to the broader economy.
Right. And there's in another way of phrasing that, or a conceptually similar way of phrasing that, say, has the last 30 years of the growth of finance, where it essentially doubles as a share of GDP, its share of profits skyrockets, a lot of people and a lot of our economy is reorientated towards finance, has that essentially been kind of a Ponzi scheme, or do we not get very much good out of that? Paul Volcker, the former Fed chair, said that, you know, the last useful financial innovation was the ATM machine, which was a slam against all these CDOs and derivatives and so on and so forth. That's a question that Dodd-Frank really kicked the can on, but it's one that we're eventually going to have to answer. And so I think the report, and you can get it at RooseveltInstitute.org, the tail end of it really digs into these questions about what should banks be allowed to do? What does it mean that we no longer have these Jimmy Stewart banks? We have these crazy financial institutions. What does it mean to have a safety net instead of regulations around that? I don't want to slam Dodd-Frank too hard. There are things in it that are, in fact, very useful. It dismantles, or at least tries very hard to dismantle, the over-the-counter derivatives market and so on and so forth. But, ultimately, there's these harder conceptual questions that we need to answer.
All right, let's go through some of the aspects of the report, and we will also link it at majority.fm, because it's you've got obviously some really fantastic thinkers and writers who are writing on this, and this is it is tricky stuff. Let's go through that first half of the, you know, we've talked on this program of all the roadblocks that Dodd-Frank has had. Ranging from the defunding by the Republican House to regulators essentially being intimidated by a sea of industry lawyers from the financial industry and those industry lawyers' friends in the in federal courts. But what would you say are the at this point the most successful provision? Both in terms of what it's going to do and its ability to actually get executed into the rules-making process of Dodd-Frank?
So anything, I think a good, useful kind of quick test is anywhere where you had a single regulator that had a coherent mission and wanted to do it has done very well. So the CFPB has been actually a very remarkable success. Even, you know, for people who are boosters of it, I think everyone's been pretty happy with its ability to write clear rules on time, deal with industry.
This is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was set up by Elizabeth Warren and Rob Corddry now leads.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big focal point in Dodd-Frank. A lot of consumer groups, union groups, activist groups really pushed for it. And they got a really strong implementation of it, so that's going very well. There's something called the CFTC, the Commodities Future and Commission, is in charge of derivatives. And it's done a really good job of dismantling this over-the-counter, opaque, not transparent market and try to put in price transparency and move things to clearing and exchanges, which has historically been used for really exotic financial instruments. I mean, they've come under budgetary pressure both from obviously now in the sequestration, but even before that with centrist Democrats trying to do grand bargains, you know, their funding's always been hit and they've been challenged by the courts that are particularly the very conservative DC courts, which Obama has just failed to try to fill early on in his presidency. But they've been doing a good job. The FDIC has to make these rules to end too big to fail. Given that it's a very hard task, I think they've been doing a very good job. Where you have problems is where you have a lot of regulators having to come together to do something, and where some of them particularly just don't have an interest in doing it. So, something called a swaps pushout, which was, something that was pushed for by activists, designed to get some of the more exotic derivatives out of banks that had, deposits and public backstops. You know, Yellen during her testimony was talking about how they could try to clip it, which was, astounding to me. But that's something that has like five regulators on it. But the Volcker rule, which we just talked about, things where banks have to retain risks when they make these sliced and diced mortgages. Those are things that are both hard decisions and also require a lot of chefs in the room. And, they've all been really problematic, if not outright disasters.
Why do they require so many different regulators? Is it because of the nature of the financial products?
It's the nature of how Dodd-Frank was written, first of all. Second is that our regulatory infrastructure is split. So you have things that are designed to either deal with, going back to the New Deal when a lot of this stuff was created, you have stuff that's designed to deal with commercial banks, and then you have a separate set of regulators who are designed to deal with finance and investment banks. And now, post-Glass-Steagall, particularly, all those lines are blurred. So all these financial institutions are both things. So you have a lot of different regulators looking at a lot of different things who all have to agree on how to regulate these brand new kind of globally mega banks. That's where a lot of the regulatory drift comes from. And it's really hard to manage outside of reconceptualization, which Dodd-Frank didn't do.
And by reconceptualization, what you're talking about is some type of return to some type of Glass-Steagall framework. I mean, it's as if, the nature of what they're regulating changed, but the regulatory framework stayed the same, and so it became much harder to do. And that's one of the big arguments, right? I mean, that people had with Dodd-Frank, it seems to me, was that it didn't take that sort of meat cleaver and say, we're just going to sort of wall off these things in a way that is more reflective of the way that we regulate these things and the way that they expose the public to risk.
Yeah, absolutely, especially when you have complex firms that, for a lot of types of regulation, regulators can go in and pretty easily figure out if meat is tainted or if these drugs aren't doing what they're supposed to do. With financial firms, it's actually very difficult for regulators to figure out what the banks are doing. They have to rely on them in some ways to give them the information that they need. So when you have that level of complexity, it's just really hard to enforce the rules sometimes. So sometimes having much simpler firms kind of siloed into certain types of activities makes it much easier to deal with in terms of providing a safety net and providing, strict accountability. That was not really the focus at all of Dodd-Frank. Some of the regulators were moved around. One particularly troublesome regulator was liquidated, but more generally, it kind of kept the infrastructure and tried to graft its responsibilities onto these new mega banks.
And so how, tell us about capital requirements. That's the chapter that you wrote in the report yourself. Tell us why capital requirements are so important and where we are on those.
I think the general consensus is moving that the capital requirements that kind of rolled out of the first process, the first iteration of Dodd-Frank, which is, you know, Dodd-Frank itself and something called the Basel III Commission in Europe, isn't enough. And you have a lot of regulators and a lot of people from kind of a lot of odd bedfellows saying that we should really be increasing these perhaps even a lot. Senator Brown and Senator David Vitter, who are very, you know, a very liberal and a very conservative senator, came together with a proposal to essentially triple capital requirements, for instance. And even people who are less pushed on that still wanting to jack them up a significant amount. So we're going to see some movement on that. What my chapter tries to emphasize is that I try to emphasize the idea that a lot of the regulations are interconnected. So capital requirements, for instance, makes things like trying to end too big to fail easier because it makes it an easier process and you can kind of set up banks to kind of have cushion to fail in a much more graceful way. It makes macroeconomic policy much easier to do because it can do things like try to alleviate bubbles without necessarily causing recessions. It makes things like something called prudential regulations. It just makes it easier to you don't have to necessarily know exactly what banks are up to because you know that they have a cushion. And, you know, a lot of people always are looking for silver bullets with regulations, or they're trying to think about the one thing we can do and then we can just get rid of everything else. And what I really wanted to focus on was the interconnectedness of all this. And, you know, people can judge how the chapter works, but there's, you know, a lot of reasons why making sure that each part of these regulations work well, because they all ultimately influence each other.
And just to be clear for folks, when we talk about capital requirements, that's basically just what the relationship between banks can bet on versus what they have to back that up.
Absolutely. It's the funding mix they use for their loans. And so it's, you know, this isn't necessarily the best way to think of it, but it's basically the money they put aside in case of hard times. And so if something goes wrong, they actually have to have some sort of cushion that would mean that they can take big losses without necessarily going into bankruptcy, which could then cause a panic among other financial institutions. If we think of banks as interconnected and having these real, or being prone to risks at once, spreading out to risks at others, then you want to change their funding mix so they're less likely to fail, even if that maybe costs them more money in terms of their profits. So there's good reasons to do that. It's not even that costly, all things considered. So, it's basically taking stuff that banks do already and then just making them have more of a cushion in that direction. I think, you know, that not only is a good idea in and of itself, it also makes all these other regulatory projects much easier and much more efficient.
Let's jump ahead to shadow banking. Explain to us what that term means and what the issue is with this shadow banking.
Sure. So at a high level, you can think of a Jimmy Smith bank or like from It's a Wonderful Life, or what people often think of is their banking. So they, you know, they go to a bank and they get a loan, perhaps for a business or for a home. And then the bank, you know, takes that loan and then it sits on it, or the bank takes that loan, evaluates whether or not it's a good prospect, and then sits on it and then collects the payments. Now that's what we would call old fashioned commercial banking. Now what we have now is something where banks or financial firms will take those loans and then put them into a security, which is then sold on the international capital markets. This is the whole slice and dice nature of what we think of mortgage-backed securities, if people are familiar with that term. But the idea is that instead of the ownership, you know, instead of who owns it and who vets it being very clear and very clean and very aligned, so the person who has to take the first loss if this loan goes bad, is the one who's ultimately, you know, the one who originates it, the one who creates it. Now there's all kinds of weird ownership claims. So you can have these fly-by-nights. So as we saw in the housing bubble, you can have these fly-by-night subprime lenders who are creating loans that are then going to be shipped off to a pension in Norway or, you know, CalPERS, for instance, the union pension fund in California, without them, you know, actually checking out the loans and knowing if they're good or bad. And then you have things like, you know, the banks are just, you know, saying that they stand behind the loans, which turned out to not be any good, or they have AIG try to put insurance on it, which turned out to not be any good, or the ratings agencies put their word on it, which turned out to not be any good. And so those kinds of mechanisms of accountability have all collapsed in the crisis, so it's not clear what's going to take its place. There's also a question about how when you have those kinds of chains, you can cause a lot of panics in them because there's a lot of distance in between decision-making. How will the Federal Reserve regulate that and try to insure it? For commercial banks like Jimmy Stewart Bank, they ultimately ended up with deposit insurance, which you have on your checking account or your savings account. What will that kind of structure look like for shadow banking? We don't have that in place yet, and that's what people are trying to figure out.
I mean, that's pretty stunning. I mean, we have this sort of whole industry that really it's not clear who regulates it. And it, you know, I guess prior to Glass-Steagall and the, sort of the chipping away that led up to Glass-Steagall, this was, I mean, to the extent that this industry existed, it was, or this shadow world existed, it was just, we were just not responsible for socializing its failure. And there's just, this is just sort of the Wild West, but in some ways it's sort of like as if the Wild West was moved into town and nobody was conscious of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you have, it's not just that there's one Wild West, but they all kind of stack on top of each other. So, you know, there's these mortgage-backed securities where people can't verify what's in them. And then people make complicated bets on those things, or they, you know, take those bets and put them into another security. It's something called a CDO. And, you know, like there's, you know, the complexity builds on the complexity, and there's just nothing there to kind of, you know, everyone thought, of course, you know, the big thing during the deregulation era was like, you know, of course these markets know best. Of course the price mechanism and, you know, all this Milton Friedman stuff, of course it's going to work out fine and put risk where it needs to go or to those who can best handle it. But instead put risk on people who are the least suited to handle it, people who were naive or got misled. It created a lot of profits and incentives for middlemen to lie and create terrible mortgages that they knew were going to fail. And so, you know, since the crisis, that market has collapsed, but it's going to eventually come back. In fact, it's starting to come back in small things. And there's still parts of it that still go, like the money market mutual funds. The question is, how do you deal with those the panics that are, you know, systemic to those things? That's still an open question. And then the chapter, it's by Marcus Stanley, the co-editor of this volume with me, I think is really sharp and kind of putting it forward in a policy direction, saying, okay, here are the things Dodd-Frank put into place, here are the things they didn't, and here's where we still need to go.
And I mean, is that the existence of the shadow banking industry, I guess, is that a, from a conceptual basis, is it something that can actually be regulated by a set of rules, or is it something that just there needs to be basically mechanisms to firewall this off from the part of the banking world that we can actually reasonably regulate?
You know, that's going to be $1 million question, or, well, it's actually trillions of dollars in question. You know, that Dodd-Frank did not go that route. So it did not try to dismantle this market. It did not. And there's things that could be done that could have tried to do it, but it did not. So we're going to be left with this for a while. So the question is, how do we put certain kinds of rules in the road into it? And there's some things that are already trying. In my chapter, I talk about something called liquidity ratios for capital. But anyway, you basically say, if you're a shadow bank, you have to hold a bunch of capital to make sure you could survive a month where Bear Stearns could not survive a month. So it's kind of that focus. There are other things about liability law and certain kinds of structuring about where mortgages come from and what requirements they have to have. But ultimately, the big questions about what the Federal Reserve is going to do next time there's a crisis is still open. And in fact, they have a responsibility to write a rule about how they won't bail out a specific firm like AIG again. And it came up in testimony with Dr. Yellen today. They haven't tried to write those rules yet. They're actually kicking the can on that. And that's really, things like that are really disturbing, which either says that they don't understand the gravity, or more likely because they're smart people, they understand the gravity and they don't know what to do. And they're hoping some sort of, you know, they can muddle through with some version of the status quo.
And I want to get to the question as to whether or not how urgent that situation is, but you also, the following chapter is one by Wally Turbeville of Demos, and in many respects, this is the argument of, like, you know, these, what the whole sort of shadow banking industry and the whole sort of new innovation in the financial markets is really serving no one short of maybe a couple of real estate agents in the Hamptons or similarly situated people. I mean, just talk to us about sort of philosophically, you know, what that argument is, because in some level, if the argument is put forth that these are not socially valuable, it's not an industry that's providing any type of a social value in the way that banking and sort of more simpler financial instruments were set up to do, why should we allow it to continue in A, just wholesale, or B, in the context of something that essentially owns our financial system?
Right. So we have two chapters on derivatives, which are these complex instruments that have evolved over the past 30 years in finance, which are essentially bets on certain types of events happening. And the first chapter is at this explains the two halves of an unfinished mission. The first chapter is at the beginning, is by an MIT professor named John Parsons, which explains what's been happening so far in trying to dismantle something called the over-the-counter derivatives market, which is, even touching this thing is what got Brooksley Bourne fired in the 1990s. The first time people tried to dismantle this market, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers forced the reformers out of office. It was a really bloody battle of the Clinton regulatory era. That turned out to be a bad call, and Dodd-Frank changed that. And, the first chapter kind of talks about how far along we are and what's working and what's not. The second chapter, in the second half, just says, is this even a good idea? Are we over-relying on derivatives and financial innovation more broadly in places where simpler ideas like just holding cash as a kind of hedge or a kind of form of insurance would be much simpler and easier? And while he walks through both the arguments for why that might be the case, and secondly, tries to argue some of the reasons why we do over-rely on derivatives and financial innovations. He argues sometimes a lot of people are just misled by finance. Finance promises a lot of money and a lot of cleverness, and it doesn't really deliver. He also argues there's things like tax law or bankruptcy law or all these kinds of little loopholes that kind of nudge people to, instead of doing things very simply, doing things in this complicated financial matter. And then there's this, this is my pet theory, is that, you see a lot of kind of cross-business solidarity, and especially in the Obama age and the Chamber of Commerce, where, businesses don't want the government to crack down on a lot of finance, so they kind of just stand by side with them, even though they don't necessarily benefit very much from this new economy we've built.
Interesting. Well, so let's just get to that last point. How urgent is the situation? In other words, where do you see the greatest dangers to a potential another sort of systemic financial collapse? How urgent is this? I mean, obviously we need to do this because we're not addressing problems that led to where we were in 08. But I mean, are we a decade out? Are we a half a decade out? Are we going to, all the real estate that's being bought up by Wall Street and then rented out? Is that going to lead to something problematic? Give us your sense of just prognosticate a little.
So I don't think we should be particularly worried right now about another bubble or another kind of repeat of what we saw in the 2000s, where, you have this giant bubble and then, a collapse. And I'm much more worried about disinflation and the idea that the economy is just going to perpetually be going too slow. And leaving way too many people unemployed and behind for the next decade. What I do worry a lot about, and what I think is what this report tries to focus on, what I think is hopefully going to be more of a focus going into 2016 presidential primaries and, other kind of future of the Democratic Party, is we're going to see the financial sector still be a very large part of our economy, where it's huge amounts of profits for a very small group of people. And we're really dubious, I think, for very good reasons, that it's providing very much value. And the question is whether or not is understanding how connected that is to, middle class squeeze, the dismantling of a lot of our public safety nets. And, you know, the kind of general bad economic conditions we're experiencing right now, and ultimately what our policy response will be to that, whether or not a Democrat will have a Democratic Party and a liberal movement that understands this as part of the problem, not part of the solution, and something that ultimately needs to be challenged and checked, which is why it was great to have Elizabeth Warren there, because I think she articulates that very well into a, not only just a regulatory failure, which is bad enough, but a bigger problem with our economy.
Let me ask you, I mean, just and I'll let you go. But when you look at quantitative easing, which is, I mean, if I remember from our past conversations, you generally favor. But I mean, it seems to me it's one of those sort of like maybe it's somewhat effective for the Fed to be basically creating this money by buying this these bonds, these derivatives from the banks, but it's definitely seems to be enhancing inequality. I mean, am I wrong in my assessment of that? That this is sort of almost a supply side type of approach. You know, granted, there's an absence of what we need on the fiscal side, but just speak to that.
Sure. So this was very apparent, and it's still true now. The government essentially has three levers to pull on to deal with the current economic crisis we have. One is fiscal policy. One, you know, just running a larger deficit, investing in people, and so on and so forth. Monetary policy, which is the Fed trying to lower rates to spur investments. And then housing policy, trying to do something about the foreclosures and the abuses and the mortgage servicing and, you know, just the kind of real mess that was made. And so the Obama administration did not do anything on housing. I mean, the HAMP program is widely seen to be a failure. A lot of us called it early, and we were right. Fiscal policy was originally tried, and now it's completely in reverse. It's in the wrong direction. The deficit is way too small, given the amount of unemployment we have right now. And the austerity at the state level in particular has been vicious. So it's unfortunate, because monetary policy should be working with other things to make a better economy, but it's kind of the only lever that's being pulled. And so I want to see it continue to be pulled, but I would prefer to see a much more broader portfolio of things in play here. As for the specifics, I mean, it's kind of complicated, because if monetary policy was tighter, we generally think that that's, you know, would cause disinflation, which would in general benefit creditors, which tend to be the very rich. So it has a really complicated effect on the wealth distribution. I think to the extent that it brings down unemployment and creates jobs, that's the kind of the first order thing that I think is really causing inequality. I mean, It might exacerbate inequality in so much as that we have a very unequal economy, period. So if the economy picks up a bit, you know, it may only mean that working people have a little bit more money, but that means a lot to them. So I'm in general in favor of much more expansionary monetary policy. I also think that the talks about bailouts, given the way finance works, a lot of it tends to net out, because it lends at these, you know, it borrows at these very low rates, but also lends at these very low rates too. So it's kind of, it's not clear to me that it's not just a problem of the financial sector, much less a problem of, you know, the Fed's policies with finance.
Mike Konzel of the Roosevelt Institute. The report is An Unfinished Mission, Making Wall Street Work for Us. You can get it at, the site is Roosevelt?
RooseveltInstitute.org, and you'll find it's called An Unfinished Mission, and you'll see it right there.
Okay, and we'll put a link to that majority.fm as well. I appreciate you coming on today, Mike.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. Coming up in the fun half of the show, we will talk about what President Obama announced and what the implications are going to be for the Affordable Care Act. I don't think it's going to be as big as people are making it. I mean, as far as the potential for a death spiral in the exchanges, I just don't think that's there to the extent that some people are suggesting. But I'm also not an expert on it, but the you know, in these times like these, you start to realize it doesn't seem like anybody is. But you know, there's sort of, you point the ship in a certain direction and check the weather and see how you're going to do, I guess.
He did point out that Medicaid expansion has been successful.
Well, yes.
And he said, you know, if more Republican governors, I think the number is 5.4 million. if more Republican governors would accept Medicaid expansion.
Right now, we're at 500,000 new people.
New, so that was his point. He was saying, like, look, there's a lot of success you're not talking about, and then there's problems that you're not talking about, and that's rejecting Medicaid funds, which is
right.
important. And then he basically just said the, you know, well, I guess we'll get to it more in the fun half.
Yes. What he said. There you go, folks. That we got to come up with like a some type of slogan where fun is sometimes super, super weedy and not fun. Something like that. The better half.
Fun way of talking about the ASA.
There you go. Also in the better half, we will play that sound of a white supremacist finding out that only 84% of him is really supreme. The other 16% seems to be somewhat less supreme for him. And, Rush Limbaugh has some wonderful things to say about women. I guess he's back. I guess now that he's lost all his advertisers, he's not as so concerned about it. Folks, just a reminder, podcastawards.com. I've told you five times what to do. Just go there right now. I don't even need to tell you what to do. You only have two more days to do it. Thursday and Friday, and you have Friday to 9 p.m. Eastern to do it. You got to vote both days. You got to do it. And then, if you haven't already, become a member at majority.fm. Just a housekeeping note. Tomorrow will be a Matt and Mike Friday because my daughter is taking a class trip to Ellis Island, and which has been closed since Sandy. And you can't get in unless you're a student, you know, unless it's like a class trip. And so they needed a chaperone. I don't know if that means that these first or these third graders, rather, are like doing stuff that, you know, they need to be chaperoned, or it's just you got to watch them as they take the subway down there. But I will be one of the chaperones tomorrow. It's going to be freezing cold. One funny story, though, I got to tell about Myla that I was so proud about that she said the other night. It was she was having an issue, and I suggested to her, how would you advise your brother, not as an 8-month-old, because Saul doesn't seem to understand anything. Well, some things, like he can slap you five now, and he can drum. And he can play catch. I mean, it's not grabbing, you know, it's not like Ken Griffey. But
go long, Dad.
Yeah, no, it's not quite there yet. But I said, when your brother is your age, when he's like 5 or 6 or 7 and you are, 13, 14, 15, 16, if your brother came to you with this problem, she was having an argument with somebody in school, came to you with this problem, what would you say? Myla's response, I'm not going to answer a hypothetical. She's been listening to the debates I'm having with libertarians and choosing to answer like they do. So there's your little cutesy story. So Matt and Mike will be here tomorrow.
Yeah, don't forget Matt and Mike Friday tomorrow, because if you have the app, you're not going to be receiving a notification for it.
Well, you know, people didn't get receiving notification today either.
Yeah,
I forget. Some days I forget.
They're going to receive a notification tomorrow. I'm confident about that.
I wouldn't be so confident.
I was trying to open a door for you.
All right.
Bastard.
In the fun half, too, we'll talk about biofuels and how they're failing to meet up with their billing. Also, just that repugnant Sheriff Arapio. When the hell is this
Arpaio.
Guy going? Arpaio. When the hell is he going to go away?
I cannot believe. I remember watching him, like, being 14 or 15 or something and seeing him come on CNN and just being like, who the hell is this guy and how does he have authority over anybody? And that was, like, 12 years ago or something.
I guess he's got a new plan.
Where were you watching CNN at 14?
friend's house.
Just making
obviously
sure.
I
yes.
needed to get away.
Yeah, Michael
of
wasn't allowed to have TV.
No TV for me.
He's come out with a new policy to deal with people who deface stickers.
Hey, yes, runny nose Mike. Can I come over and watch some CNN?
All right, folks. Things are getting a little testy. Matt and Mike Friday may be pretty testy. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920, or you can IM me if you want to be a part of the program. We'll be back in just a moment.